everyone. I want to give you a little bit of an update right quickly about the work. We have ended the year with a 31% increase over last year. And to give you an idea of where that is, it's over $1.8 million that we have had come in and mostly go back out in the course of the year. But it has given me the flexibility to be able to not only order some new booklets, but to take on a lot of new television. We've taken on one over in Sacramento for $850 every half hour. We've added the Buffalo station for about $600 or $700, I forget how much. We're also adding another one in Norfolk, Virginia. We've shifted to a much better time in Raleigh. And there's one other I'm forgetting about right now that we will put in the newspaper. We're now on 33 television stations all over the country and about 5 radio. As soon as my son Mark gets back from a brief vacation over the holidays out of the country temporarily, well, we're going to begin doing some radio spots for Australia. And our Australian group down there are going to place them on radio here and there around Australia. And I'm having people look into Australian television as well. The newspaper just went out and should be received by people, if it hasn't been already, very shortly. I'm about to complete another TCW, or 21st Century Watch. I've been very sporadic with regard to that simply because of the income and watching our P's and Q's and not trying to bite off more than we can chew. I've now written 21 of those Word From commentaries since 9/11, several of which are booklet size in length and several of which I've converted into brochures, which I've advertised on a television program to send out. We have been breaking every record imaginable on the website ever since 9/11, and especially in a few weeks after that time. And I don't know the statistics right now, but I can give them to you later on, perhaps in a newspaper, as far as the number of referrals are concerned. We have a page there that asks the question, where is the closest church or fellowship group nearest my home? And we have quite a large number of people, and we send those on out to all the area coordinators, and then they follow up on them. I know that some of them are mere curiosity. Well, I wonder if there's somebody near us. Some of them merely want to find out, and sometimes when they are contacted, the person will find that the interest is only a little bit skin deep. So it doesn't mean that every one of the people who are referred are going to necessarily begin attending church, but a lot of them do, and that is wonderful. By the way, by the time we're in the new building, and I can't announce when that will be yet, I hope it's going to be the middle or latter part of February, but I'm just having to wait day by day by day to see how it's going. We would need every one of you to bring about 3 more people with you, please. Other than that, we're going to have to put up some screens or something in the back because it'll probably just standard theater seating around 260, but if we crowd it, we could probably get up to 300 in there. We'll wait and see, and we'll have to comply with the fire marshal laws, but it's going to be considerably larger than these little motel rooms we've been meeting in. You know, it's really exciting to me, and I've been reading and studying a good bit lately, once again, and going through some things about American history, Washington and Jefferson and Adams and the second president, and Madison, who followed Jefferson, and Madison, who was little Jimmy Madison, as they called him, who was the Secretary of State under Jefferson. I was shocked recently, and I think I told you this, when I heard over Paul Harvey that only 34% of the graduates of American colleges and universities could identify and really knew who and what George Washington was all about. It just dumbfounded me that they are not teaching American history in our colleges and universities, and that they're not getting that apparently in high school. I saw a statistic not very many months ago that gave the curriculum for the 8th grade in the days when my father grew up. And the average college graduate could not begin to answer the test questions and to measure up to 8th graders at that time. It was simply unbelievable. Now, as I've been looking through some of that, I have seen some incredible parallels, not only with biblical history, with some of the great pioneers and champions of the Bible, but also a little bit of an interesting overlap with some of the things that have happened in God's church in the last 50 years. I think about some of the great pioneers of history, and you know a lot of them. Profane history tells us about men like Pliny and Strabo and Alexander and Hannibal, Marco Polo, Magellan, who circumnavigated the entire globe, Eric the Red, who established a colony in Vineland all the way to Minnesota, way back before Columbus was ever heard of, Henry Hudson, Ponce de Leon, Alvarez and Cabeza de Vaca, who investigated Texas, New Mexico, and all the way up to Santa Fe, Frobisher, Columbus, the Pilgrims at Plymouth Rock, Drake, Anson. How many people pick up books and read the real history about Sir Francis Drake, of his savaging of the various Spanish colonies and forts all over Central America and the Caribbean, and especially in Panama, and the incredible hardships some of these people faced, and about the defeat of the Spanish Armada, the hand of God, the absolute miracles that occurred to have this tiny force beat that overwhelming, huge Spanish Armada and save Britain from Spanish rule. There are so many great and overwhelming stories in history of incredible hardship and sacrifice against such overwhelming odds, against completion of their vision, goal, or mission. Even their very survival was at stake many times, and the fact that they even survived stands your hair on end. As I began reading about how Captain Meriwether Lewis was called by Jefferson to become a personal secretary, and later on was sent by Madison to investigate the headwaters of the Columbia and try to find whether or not this great nation actually did have dual drainages from this side of the Rockies down to the Mississippi from the Missouri, and he reasoned that instead of the British claim that there were actually the headwaters of the Missouri and some of the other rivers like the Columbia up in Canada, he said it's way too far north, and it makes sense to me that there will be a northwest passage south of the British fur traders and these people in Canada, and he sent Lewis and Clark to investigate it. When I was a boy growing up in Oregon, because they went to Oregon, they went to the Columbia, from the Snake down to the Columbia, they crossed the Continental Divide, they spent the entire first winter in 1802 up in what is now South Dakota, where they met Charbonneau, I think his name was, or Carbonneau, whatever you, how you pronounce it, and Sacagawea, who took them over to the Shoshone Indians, where they got horses and traded them in for their flatboats, and went all the way to Oregon and built a place on Fort Clatsop that is now Seaside, where I used to play in the sand as a boy. And to realize what it must have been like to those people after two solid years of struggle to get over those mountains and canoe up and down rivers and everything, of wild animals and savage Indians and our own health and horrible blizzards and poor food and nowhere near the kind of clothing like our parkas and stuff we take for granted we can pick up at Walmarts today. And they had animal skins and hides and things like that to shelter them. And you read of what they went through, what they did, and you come back to the planners in Washington, men with an incredible vision. And I did not know some of this until very recently, that not just once, not even twice, but many times, the very existence of the United States as a nation hung in the balance. Whether or not we would be a little nation along the Atlantic seaboard with the French in charge of the entire middle section of the country, the Russians and the British in charge of the Pacific Northwest, the Spanish in charge of Louisiana, choking off all travel up and down the Mississippi. It's just incredible. I did not know that the Federalist Party was urging the entire original New England colonies to split off and to form a separate country all of their own, when the original Democratic Republican Party was both hyphenated, Democrat Republican Party was formed in the days of Thomas Jefferson. I didn't know about the tie between Jefferson and Burr and the, you know, duel that took place a little later on. There were so many things that I didn't know, little details. And I've been studying into it as much as I can, and I wanted to find out about Dolly Madison. They always said she was such a pretty woman. Well, the pictures that I've seen of her paintings don't bear that out, but they thought that at the time. And the state dinners, and when you read about people coming into the Rotunda, and there were people there with charbroilers that were selling hot dogs and things inside the building, and you read of people stepping through horse manure and weeds, pardon me for saying that, on their way down to the place they lived, which is what now is the mall, and you read about Washington, D.C. begun to be planned as the nation's capital, just like Brasilia in Brazil, from scratch, where they went out into horse pastures and laid out these gigantic streets with nothing on them, and read about these men slogging around on horses. It is just mind-boggling. But what is really mind-boggling to me is that the men who were involved had a sense of their destiny. They had a sense of the national destiny and of what they were about and of what they were struggling and fighting for. They had incredible visions of a nation instead of being a little piddling bunch like the Federalists want, up in New England, because that's where all the industry and the shipping and the economy really was. They had New York going along with them and New Jersey going along with them, and from Virginia on south was basically all agrarian, and they looked upon them as backwoods hillbillies, and the elitists and the intelligentsia in the New England colonies were really pretty much Anglophiles. They loved Britain and the idea of royalty. And it was a very, very near thing that it didn't split off into a separate government. How we survived the Civil War is almost beyond comprehension when you stop to think about it. And that God provided that one correct, perfect man for the job, Abraham Lincoln, at that point in time, or perhaps it would not have come out the way it did. So many narrow escapes. And the men who were involved, Washington, Adams, Hamilton, Jefferson, all of them, certainly Adams, and later on, three presidents later, his son John Quincy, who was chased down in the White House by Little Jimmy, as they called him at that time, and told him that he ought to get involved with the Democrat-Republican Party, when in fact he was a Federalist. Some of these things about how our nation survived all of this, and how we gradually became a great nation, the Louisiana Purchase that more than doubled the size of the United States by 1804, that fulfilled major biblical prophecies that none of them who were participants had any knowledge of. They didn't have the faintest idea about 2,520 years of deprivation of national inheritance on the part of Israel, and that it worked out right exactly to the day that that huge amount of territory going up into what is partially now Canada, to the headwaters of the Mississippi and Missouri, all the way to New Orleans. And Andrew Jackson, what kind of a man he was, and how he moved into the Hermitage, and he went down and fought the British down in New Orleans in the Battle of New Orleans. Unbelievable. Now, what I'm coming to is simply this. Those men all were great pioneers. Their entire lives were dedicated to what they were about. Lewis and Clark almost lost their lives. It took them 2 years, and when they finally showed up again after splitting up on the way back, one of them to investigate the Yellowstone, the other one further south, and met once again in St. Louis, the people who saw them didn't even believe they were alive. They'd been given up for dead for about a year. And what that did to open up travel, the mountain men, the fur traders, and to show people there was a Northwest Passage across the Rockies all the way to the Pacific coast, when the Russians had a colony in San Francisco, and the British, with the British fur trade, had a colony in Vancouver, on Vancouver Island, in what is now Canada. And that they were also putting their hegemony and their armed forces, and there were quite interesting battles that took place over that, and were claiming all of Oregon territory. I see incredible parallels as I look at what has happened in the last 50 years in God's church. And I wonder sometimes if we know on a daily and a weekly and a monthly basis what we are about, what we are part of, what we are destined to become, who it is who truly is at the helm of what it is we are doing. Because if all we are is a tiny little split off of a split off of a split off, hidden out here in the East Texas piney woods with a little religious organization gradually growing and eking out an existence and trying to publish more booklets and more brochures and have more church members and raise up more churches. If we get our eyes on these short-range goals and we lose sight of the vision of the really big picture, then we will not complete the mission as we should. You know, I think of Adam. I'm going to go to Genesis 1:26, because here was a man, talk about a pioneer. Here was a man, even though they blew it from a standpoint of what happened to them and their family and being kicked out of the idyllic absolute paradise in which they were placed. I mean, Adam had the entire world to investigate before him. He was the only human being, together with his wife, anywhere around. He wasn't going to encounter any savages or any other nations who would be hostile to him setting foot in their country. God said, verse 26, "Let us make man in our image." There are four or five sermons and a couple of booklets right there, aren't there? Because that's exactly what he did. We're merely a human physical prototype of the spiritual God Almighty in heaven above, who is reproducing after his own kind. "After our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the fowl of the air, over the cattle, over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. Male and female created he them. And God blessed them, certainly did. And God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply. thus destroying the old idea, the Augustinian guilt complex of the idea that the first sin was sexual intercourse between a man and his wife. Nonsense, but some churches have taught that. And subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over every living thing that moves upon the earth. And God said, Behold, I have given you the herb bearing seed, every herb which is upon the face of the earth, and every tree which is the fruit of a tree yielding seed, so you, or to you, it shall be for meat. And to every beast of the earth, and to every fowl of the air, and everything that creepeth upon the earth, wherein there is life, I have given every green herb for meat, and it was so. So Adam lived in paradise. Talk about pioneers. Talk about living in an area with no near neighbors. They lived in the world's most beautiful and private bedroom, didn't they? There was no one within eyesight or earshot or anywhere for 1,000 miles in all directions. And they had it all to themselves. We know what happened to them, but they were in a perfect environment with a perfect mate, peaceful, non-threatening animals, wonderful weather, no blizzards, no tornadoes, no typhoons, no mudslides or floods, no forest fires. Everything was beautiful. And in spite of that, they blew it because of human nature. I want to go to the story of Noah. We all know about it, so I won't read Genesis 6 and 7 and how the wickedness of man was so exceeding great that God said he was going to destroy all of mankind. And only Noah found, well, mercy from God during his generation. Noah was commissioned to build a huge vessel, and he had 120 years to get the job done. Now, do you suppose during that time, as Noah had to commission people to go out and prepare the site, had to have people with animals and vehicles to actually drag huge big timbers, cedars of Lebanon, whatever was he used all kinds of hardwoods, and they're even talked about in the sixth chapter of the book of Genesis. He had this gigantic vessel, and he had to draw up plans, certainly. Well, God had told him the dimensions, what they ought to be, but he had to draw up plans on how everything fit together. He may have hired eventually hundreds of people at any one time that were working on that ark. So it was Noah's life's work. It was his project, and it's called not Shem, Ham, and Japheth's ark. It is not called the ark of the time of Noah. It is called Noah's ark because it was not only Noah's commission and his job and his goal, but it was his means of survival and his very means of salvation, physical salvation. And who knows, spiritual as well, because after all, God had commissioned him to build it and commanded him to do so. Now, many times I've talked about people who, quote, grew up in the shadow of the ark, and how for 120 years, you're talking about maybe five generations where people had grown old and were grandparents and great-grandparents, and their children maybe went to work, and their great-granddaddy would sit there, oh, yes, I used to work in the days when we laid the keel. You know, they could talk about the days when it first began to be put together. So no doubt hundreds, maybe thousands eventually, of people earned their living working for Noah. There must have been quite a society that built around it, grew up around that thing, because it was absolutely as big as some of the ocean liners clear up into the late 1800s, as I've read to you before. It was a huge vessel, a tremendous project. What kind of faith, what kind of tenacity and perseverance did it take for a man whose back would hurt, whose wife may or may not have been a little bit difficult to live with from time to time, whose kids didn't always obey him, other people who ridiculed him and made fun of old nutty Noah trying to put together a big building, a big ship out here in a cornfield? How many times was he tempted before he went to bed just to give up, just to chuck it all and quit? It must have taken tremendous tenacity, especially when things would go wrong. How many times was somebody's foot crushed? How many times did somebody lose a finger? How many times did somebody put a draw knife into his shin? How many times did that guy go home and nearly tear his hair about everything that was going wrong with the subcontractors? It must have driven him nearly out of his mind. But he persevered. He said, we're going to build it. That thing is going to float. Someday, the old ark's a mover. And remember the old Negroes, or they used to call it Negro spiritual, can't say it anymore. But anyway, the old African-American spiritual, the old ark's a mover and a mover. And the old ark's a mover. And 40 days, rain, and all those old songs, 40 days and 40 nights, the rain kept a falling. Tell me, Noah, didn't it rain? Oh, there are some wonderful old songs about that. But I like to think about the reality of it. I like to get myself projected into the middle of it where I can hear it and smell it and see it, and where I can reach out and touch it, and where I'm living what they went through at that time, and realize it's real, it's true, and someday God is going to melt the ice and show it to us. Some people claim that it's already been found. I'm not sure about that, but I hope that that is true. If you will turn now to Genesis 12, verses 1 through 9, here's the calling of a man named Abram. The Eternal had said to Abram, "Get thee out of thy country, and from your kindred, leave your family," that's cousins and uncles and brothers and sisters and father and mother, whoever was there, "and from your father's house, unto a land that I will show you. And I will make of thee a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing." Now what a commission that was, and what a tremendous promise. "I will bless them that bless you, and curse him that curses you. And in you shall all families of the earth be blessed." I could stand here for 4 hours and tell you how that has been true. Through what God has given to Northwestern Europe, to the Scandinavian countries, especially to Britain and the once proud British Empire and the United States. And how it is that one nation after another, from Central Africa to India and Bangladesh, from all of Australasia and the islands of the Pacific, to the parts of the world inhabited by Aboriginals, including Canada, the United States, and so many other parts of the world, and how the entire world has been greatly blessed. I know that revisionists and other people will tell it the other way, by the very existence of Britain and the United States. Nation after nation that were indulging in human sacrifice. Cow dung societies like India, where they burn the bodies and put the ashes from the Ghats right into the Ganges River and then jump in it and bathe and drink it and rub it on their head and think that that's a religious exercise. It wasn't until the late 1800s and the time of the Sepoy Rebellion that some of the wives of the Rajas were prevented from literally throwing themselves on a funeral pyre when their husband was cremated. And there were times in that incredible religion of the Hindus who would not eat any animal products. When I remember one servant who came in as his British master was breaking an egg and doing his own cooking that morning, and when the servant saw him break an egg into the pan, it so revolted him he ran outside and vomited. And these people of this day worship cows, and yet they are absolutely malnutritioned and have a tremendous, protein deficiency in that country, which actually affects the mind and the body. And it just, when I think about what Britain has meant, we know the dismantlement of the colonial empires of all the great colonial powers began shortly after World War II, and all that Britain has lost. But we also know all that she gained during that time when God gave to Britain and later to the United States all the sea gates of our enemies and all these incredible possessions all over the world. And that there are many, many nations now, independent, developing nations, some of them developed nations, who wouldn't even exist if it had not been for British colonialism. We can look at the brutality, we can look at all the so-called exploitation and so on, but a lot of this has come to be true exactly as God said it would. "In you shall all families of the earth be blessed." Now, spiritually, if you be Christ, then are you Abraham's seed and heirs according to the promise. Then eventually, spiritually, all of these Gentile nations will be blessed as well. Here's a beautiful three words. Here God commissions him, portrays to him what's going to happen, tells him what will become of him, and it just says, "So Abram departed." I've always loved that. No argument, but Lord, how many this, how long, how arduous, how come I can't take my father with me? No hesitation. "So Abram departed, as the Lord had spoken unto him. And Lot went with him, and Abram was 75 years old when he departed out of Haran. And Abram took Sarai, his wife, and Lot, his brother's son, and all their substance that they had gathered, and the souls they had gotten in Haran. And they went," and that proves again that the word soul merely means people. "And they went forth to go into the land of Canaan. Into the land of Canaan they came." Hundreds of miles over a lot of terrain that today is mostly desert, but back then was forested. And by the way, there were lions in Israel in the days of David, weren't there? And you can imagine how many of them there might have been during the days of Abram, or Abraham as his name became. "And Abram passed through the land into the place of Shechem, into the plain of Moreh, and a Canaanite was then in the land. And the Eternal appeared unto Abram and said, Unto your seed will I give this land. And there he built an altar unto the Eternal, who appeared unto him. And he removed from thence unto a mountain on the east of Bethel." This is the very heights of what is now the very rugged chain of mountains in which Jerusalem has been built. And there he built an altar, pitched his tent, having Bethel on the west and Hai on the east, and there he built an altar unto the Eternal, and called upon the name of the Eternal. And Abram journeyed, going on still toward the south. What a journey! And you're going by camel and horse and mule and Shank's mare, and you're going for hundreds of miles, strange vistas, snow-capped mountains in the distance like Hermon, plenty of valleys and streams and rivers to ford and to cross, forest, animals, lions around, dangerous animals, and all of this in a pioneering way, not unlike the Boer trekkers of South Africa or the pioneers of the United States with their creaking wagons, who took months and sometimes a year and a half or two to cross terrain that we can cross now in a jet airplane in 2.5-3 hours. Easily, you can go from Dallas-Fort Worth and go to Portland, Oregon in about 2.5 hours, and it took them, and they were up in St. Louis, 2 years, a year each way. They had to stop for the entire winter up along the area in North Dakota and got wintered in up there. There's Lewis and Clark. And we just take it for granted today, but the hardship some of those pioneers endured is just unimaginable. Let's turn to 1 Samuel 16, 1-13. The Eternal said unto Samuel, "How long will you mourn for Saul, seeing I rejected him from reigning over Israel? Fill your horn with oil and go, and I will send you to Jesse the Bethlehemite, for I provided me a king among his sons." And Samuel said, "How shall I go? If Saul hear it, he will kill me." Obviously, he would be terribly jealous. And the Eternal said, "Take an heifer with you, and say, I am come to sacrifice to the Eternal. And call Jesse to the sacrifice, and I will show you what you shall do. And you shall anoint unto me him whom I name unto thee." And Samuel did that which the Eternal spake, came to Bethlehem. The elders of the town trembled at his coming, and said, "Are you coming in peace?" And he said, "Peaceably, I'm come to sacrifice." Sanctified Jesse and said, "Call your sons." And when they came, he looked on Eliab and said, "Surely the Lord's anointed is before him." Must have been tall and handsome and a beautiful young man. But the Eternal said unto Samuel, "Look not on his countenance or on the height of his stature, because I have refused him. For the Eternal sees not as a man seeth, for a man looketh on the outward appearance, but the Eternal looks on the heart." How I wish all of us could learn that lesson and never, never forget it. That God looks on the heart. He looks in the inward heart of people and their own motives. And when people have repented and they've accepted baptism, they've come into God's church. I remember so many times baptizing many, many people back when I took a trip with Rod Meredith in 1955, a couple of days after our son David was born. And we'd wade out into a cattle tank or a stream or a river, Swift River, I remember somewhere down near Fredericksburg and over in Louisiana. And we would wade out there and tell people what we were going to do and have them splash water in their face. And then we would hold their hand, one hand with their hand over their nose. But before that, before baptizing them, we would always ask a simple question. "Have you," and then list their full name, "repented of your sins?" And they would say, "Yes, I have." Now, if they haven't, and you go ahead and baptize them, what responsibility remains on your head? Zero. Absolutely none. Because you see, they say to you or to whoever's baptizing them, "Yes, they've repented of their sins." From that time on, it's between them and God, isn't it? Between them and God. And anything that they've held back or anything that they haven't really repented of is a problem they'll have to sort out between them and God, but it does not taint or soil the garments of the person who does the baptizing. Interesting concept, and I think we need to learn, because it is true. God says he looks into the hidden. When he says the heart, he means really the innermost motives and agendas and excuses and all of that of the human mind, the human brain. He's talking about the innermost conscience of human beings. So, he said, Jesse called Abinadab, made him pass before Samuel, and he said, "Neither has the Eternal chosen this." I don't know if Abinadab felt bad when he was called this instead of him, but doesn't say. Then Jesse made Shammah to pass by, and he said, "Neither hath the Eternal chosen this." Well, of course, it means this one or this young man, but I'm just kidding. Again, Jesse made 7 of his sons to pass before Samuel, and Samuel said to Jesse, "The Eternal has not chosen these." And Samuel said to Jesse, "Are here all your children?" And he said, "Well, there remains yet the youngest, and behold, he keeps the sheep." And Samuel said to Jesse, "Send and fetch him, for we will not sit down till he come hither." And he sent and brought him in. Now he was ruddy, and I believe that does mean red-haired, reddish, and very light-complexioned, and withal of a beautiful countenance. So he was a handsome young lad, and goodly to look to, probably wiry. He maybe was shorter and slighter a build than his brothers, but he was certainly well put together with you reading this description. He had to be certainly very, very powerfully built. The Eternal said, "Arise and anoint him, for this is he." That must have just shocked Jesse and certainly made all the other boys jealous and incredulous. They couldn't believe it. Then Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him in the midst of his brethren, and the Spirit of the Eternal came upon David from that day forward. So Samuel rose up and went to Ramah. Let's look at 1 Samuel 17 for a moment, because I won't read all of this. It would take a lot of time. But here is the occasion of the war between the Philistines and Israel, and of course David and Goliath. Now all of them went out there in the army, the young boys that were older than David, but they were the sons of Jesse. And every single day, it seems, there was this Philistine coming out and challenging them. And David finally came to the scene of the battle, verse 26 of 1 Samuel 17, and said, "What shall be done to the man that kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? And who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" Fascinating how David immediately focused in on the presence of God, the power of God, not the army, not the numbers in the army, not the size of the men, not the way they were armored, not their weapons or anything like that, but how can, and who is he? In other words, here was a problem. And all of these other people were quavering in front of this problem. They were scared to death. They weren't about to go out and fight that giant, probably stood about 10, 11, 12 feet tall. They just let that intimidate them and overwhelm them. But to David, it was just a piddling little thing. It was a minor little detail. Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? David had in mind how great is God, how powerful is God, how unlimited is his power and might. And so it didn't make sense that there could be a giant out there defying the armies of the living God. And the people told him after this manner, saying, "So and so shall it be done to the man that kills him, because Saul had said he can have my beautiful young daughter, and I'll make him this and that, and I'll give him all kinds of rewards." Eliab, his eldest brother, heard when he spake to the men, and Eliab's anger was kindled against David, some brotherly jealousy here. And he said, "Why do you come down hither, and with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know your pride and the naughtiness of your heart." Well, he knew of no such thing. But that just shows human nature. He was jealous. He was angry. And he probably had a little pang of conscience because he was also a coward. He was not out, even not about to go out and fight that giant. Not him. So here's his little brother. And he said, "You're come down that you might see the battle." I've always enjoyed that. Battle, battle, what battle? You know, come down to see the battle. Nobody's fighting. I mean, they're cowering in their tents. "You come down here to see us big men of war fighting." Well, nobody was fighting. David said, "What have I done now? Isn't there a reason for all of this? Isn't there a cause?" He turned from him toward another, and spake after the same manner, and the people answered him again after the former manner. And when the words were heard which David spake, they rehearsed them before Saul, and he sent for him. And David said to Saul, "Let no man's heart fail because of him. Thy servant will go and fight with the Philistine." Talk about courage. But it wasn't braggadocio, and it wasn't courage of physical prowess or strength or ability. It was faith in God. It was just like Gamaliel saying, "You better not fight against this, lest haply be found to fight against the eternal God. If this be a work of man, it will come to nothing. But if it be the work of God, you cannot overthrow it, lest you be found to fight against God." So this kind of faith just said, God has all power. God is unlimited. God will take care of it. And in that frame of mind, David is saying that he knew that something would be done about it. "Thy servant will go and fight with the Philistine." Saul said to David, "You're not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him. You're but a youth, and he is a man of war, a trained soldier from his youth." And David said unto Saul, "Your servant kept his father's sheep, and there came a lion and a bear, and took a lamb out of the flock. And I went out after him, and smote him, and delivered it out of his mouth. When he arose against me, I caught him by his beard, and smote him, and slew him." How did that happen? I can't imagine. All I know is he probably carried a knife, but he probably jammed his fist clear down the lion's throat so the lion couldn't close on it, maybe choked him, but he had a hold of his mane, was maybe riding on his back like Tarzan or something. But God was with him. God helped him. It doesn't say that there wasn't a single claw mark or a tooth mark on him. He might have had a few claw marks or tooth marks. It doesn't say there wasn't a single bruise, but he was not maimed. He wasn't seriously injured, and he killed a great big lion by his bare hands and with whatever little implement. Maybe he had a knife that he used to kill him. And he said, "Thy servant slew both the lion and the bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine shall be as one of them, seeing he has defied the armies of the living God." That was all he needed to know. He's defied God's armies. It wasn't a personal thing. It was between God and this uncircumcised Philistine. And he was standing in God's way. And David knew what the outcome was going to be. David said, "The Eternal that delivered me out of the paw of the lion and out of the paw of the bear, he will deliver me out of the hand of this Philistine." And Saul said, "Go, and the Lord be with you." So they tried to put Saul's armor on him, and it was so huge and heavy, and Saul apparently was about 7 feet tall. It said that he was shoulder, head and shoulder above every other man in Israel, and there were some big dudes, if you want to put it that way, in that nation at that time, some of them pretty good-sized men. And so Saul probably was like our 7-foot basketball players today, and the average man was probably about 5'9 or something like that. Who knows? We don't really know that for sure. We just know that Saul was a lot taller. David girded his sword upon his armor and essayed to go, for he had not proved it or tried or tested it. And David said, "I can't go with these. I haven't tested them." And David took them off of him. I can just see David there with a helmet too big for him and greaves and a great big old sword, a two-handed sword like a claymore that probably went to the ground like that, and a great big huge shield that he could hardly lift, and all his armor sagging on him. He just took it all, threw it away in a corner, and said, "I'm going out the way I took care of the lion and the bear." So he said, he took his staff in his hand and chose him 5 smooth stones out of the brook. Now, do you suppose David had ever practiced with that thing? I mean, you all know the kind of a sling he had. It's the kind that some kids have. Most of them don't. They have what's called a slingshot. But this is a long piece of leather with a little pocket down here, and you whirl it like that, and it will actually, a steel ball bearing or something, penetrate a couple of inches of pine board. It would kill someone instantly, even if you hit him in the chest. It is very, very lethal. I don't know if it's 100 miles an hour or 200 miles an hour or what, but that pellet is going. But why did he choose smooth stone? Well, he'd done it who knows how many hundreds or thousands of times. And, you know, for months and years, you're out there and you got this thing, bang, you know, and you're practicing hitting a twig or a log or a stump or maybe a bird sitting on a branch somewhere or maybe a wild animal to chase them away. You get very good with it. And I've seen knife throwers, and I've seen people that will become so good that they can literally, well, you've seen the circus thing, and they're not faking it, throwing knives at this girl pinioned on a board and knives coming right next to her, and they're so good with it that you're just, I want to say deadly accurate, I'll say undeadly accurate with them. So he chose 5 smooth stones and put them in a shepherd's bag. Notice that he chose 5. He didn't just take one. Now that's interesting as well. So that shows that he thought, well, I could miss the first one or the first 2 or 3. So I'll take a little reservoir here, a little extra. And his sling was in his hand, and he drew near to the Philistine. And the Philistine came on and drew near unto David, and the man that bare the shield went before him, apparently a little guy that had his great big shield right in front of Goliath. When the Philistine looked about and saw David, he just impugned, disdained him, for he was but a youth and ruddy and of a fair countenance. The Philistine was probably dark and swarthy and long, lanky hair. Reminds me of one of the greasy-looking terrorists of today. I'd like to think of him that way. And David was a clean-cut, young, fair-haired, nice-looking young man. The Philistine said, "What am I, a dog, that you come out here with sticks?" And the Philistine cursed David by his god, Dagon and whoever. And the Philistine said to David, "Come to me, and I will give your flesh unto the fowls of the air and to the beasts of the field." Then said David to the Philistine, "You come to me with a sword and with a spear and with a shield, but I come to you in the name of the Eternal of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defiled," or defied rather. "This day will the Eternal deliver you into my hand, and I'm going to smite you, and I'm going to take your head off of you. And I will give the carcasses of the host of the Philistines this day to the fowls of the air and of the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know there is a God in Israel." And all this assembly shall know that the Eternal saves not with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and He will give you into our hands. Great lesson for us on any kind of a problem or a battle that we have, whether it's financial, whether it's emotional, whether it's spiritual, whether it's physical health. The battle is not ours, but the Eternal's. When you shift it onto His shoulders and you just get out from under it yourself, and you just give Him the battle and say, the battle belongs to God. It's God's problem. That makes me feel so good. When terrible problems come along, I can get on my knees, and at the end of the prayer, I can just say, now, Father, I have just given You this problem. I've just absolutely just handed it over to You. Now, I don't have it anymore. It's not my problem anymore. I'm just unburdened of it. I don't have to shoulder it. Don't have to stew over it. I don't have to let it rob me of sleep. I don't have to go around every day, what'll I do about this? It's just gone now. You've got it. I don't have it anymore. And this is a very good scripture to remind us of that. It came to pass when the Philistine arose and came and drew nigh to meet David, that David hasted and ran toward the army to meet the Philistine. He ran toward the problem. He didn't run away from the problem and hide out and think it'll just go away. He ran toward it. He dealt with it. And David put his hand in his bag and took thence a stone and slang it and smote the Philistine in the forehead, that the stone sunk into his forehead and he fell upon his face to the earth. Some people have imagined that the helmet that they wore only had one tiny little opening in the forehead. I don't know if that's true or not, or whether he was wearing one that completely concealed the forehead and it actually penetrated a little bit of metal. Doesn't tell us, but at least it hit him right in between the eyes, right in the forehead, and of course went into the brain, so you know how fast he slung it at him. So David, he fell upon his face. That would be something to see, wouldn't it? 10 feet. Ooh, I mean, not even putting his hands down. He's dead while he's standing there and falls like he would fell a huge old tree and just smashed his nose and his face and everything. Boom! Dust flying. He's lying there absolutely not even quivering. And you can imagine the effect on these guys looking down in the valley and seeing this fellow 10 feet tall toppling over like he'd felled a fir tree. And it says that David then took his sword, and by the way, later on, the Bible shows that David used that sword later on, and it was a huge big sword. You had to wield it with two hands, and he took his sword, that is Goliath's sword, and just chopped his head off with it. Cut his head therewith. When the Philistines saw their champion was dead, they fled. And the men of Judah and of Israel, I've seen that happen among human beings. That's what we're trying to do right now with this guy Bin Laden. People do look to a champion. They look to a human leader. And oftentimes, if you get that leader, then they just disappear. They go right back in the woodwork. They got no more charismatic leader to follow, and they're just gone. They're disorganized and don't know what further to do. And that's, of course, what the United States hopes, although they know that other people will come to take his place. One guy's already been anointed to become his successor, and they're looking for him. But it's just a point that I think is obvious here in history. The men of Israel and of Judah arose and shouted and pursued the Philistines until they came to the valley of the gates of Ekron, and the wounded of the Philistines fell down by the way of Shearim, even unto Gath and to Ekron, places that sometimes might be located and sometimes not in modern Israel. And the children of Israel returned from chasing after the Philistines and spoiled their tents. Well, I won't go on and on and on about that, but isn't that a fascinating account? And something that actually did take place. This is real history, not fanciful or merely mythological, but actually true, and it really did happen. Now then, I want us to realize what some of these men gave up. There were people, when Meriwether Lewis took off on that visit, on that trip rather, to go across the nation, he had to leave his wife at home. And I remember how people would call James Madison Little Jimmy Madison. And now Meriwether Lewis, you see, was a captain in the army, and he was called from the wilderness, clear out in Kentucky somewhere, to come and to be the personal secretary to the President of the United States. And he heard a talk at dinner one time with all these plottings going on that the French were going to try to go ahead and clamp down and to possess, kick the Spanish out of New Orleans, and to possess all of the Mississippi drainage in the entirety of the other half of the country. And so the move to send Lewis and Clark across the country was done in order to put the foot down, carry the flag over there, make a claim, open it up, and say it's a natural consequence of our growth ever westward that we're going to open up the west of the United States. You've heard about Fremont. You've heard about all of these things. I hope you've read a great deal about them. It is fascinating. But the sacrifices that these men made, and their wives and the women that went with them on some occasions, just enormous when you stop to think of the hardships that many of them endured. The Apostle Paul, when he was called of God, later on he said, I could have led around a wife like Peter does and the other apostles, but he said it wasn't necessary and I couldn't because of the rigors of my job, of the journeys, the places I had to go. So he began by giving up station, friends, background. After all, he said, I was a Hebrew of the Hebrews. He was a member of the Sanhedrin. He was knocked down and converted and began to teach and preach the very religion that he had been persecuting. And so what do you think about all of his former associates? What would they have thought of him? He was certainly a pioneer in every sense of the word. I look at some of these great men, and more as I've read about it, and more have I studied our original documents and our Declaration of Independence, which James Madison wrote. It was actually almost a carbon copy of what he had written for the state of Virginia. And very little cosmetic changes were made by the others in the first Congressional Congress to actually adopt that Constitution. I put that almost on a plane of sacred documents, because I do know that God Almighty had a hand in guiding the minds of the men who formulated it and who gave it and put it as the document that actually states who we are as a nation. Now, we know that constitutional crises come along and the people are continually trying to do something contrary to the Constitution. But see, if you go back and you realize how often constitutional crises have gone all the way to the Supreme Court, and the people argue to this day about the Second Amendment rights with regard to the right to keep and bear arms. There's a huge furor over that right now, and has been for decades in the United States. But people are still trying to tear apart the fabric of that original document that little Jimmy Madison wrote. And when I look at all that has happened over these years, and what a near thing, what a narrow thing, what a bare escape it was that we ever even survived as the United States of America, it just stands my hair on end. And I see the hand of God in it time and time again. There have been many times that I had no idea why what happened here or what happened there took place in God's church over the last 50 years. Only later, sometimes 10, 20 years later, I will look back and I say, oh, now I see why that was allowed to happen. Because I couldn't have done this, or we wouldn't have done that, or this wouldn't have been done if that hadn't happened first. It would have gone down and out, been completely destroyed a long time ago. I don't want to mention any names. But if I had ended up in the clutches, or in the hands of, or under the control of some people I could tell you about 25 years ago, I can't imagine what would have happened to the work of God, or to me personally, at that time. Now looking back, I can see what was allowed to take place. But you know, I read from time to time our own Constitution and bylaws. I read the document that actually says who and what is the Garner Ted Armstrong Evangelistic Association and the Intercontinental Church of God. And I realize that there was a great deal of wisdom and a great deal of history and a great deal of experience from past organizations that went into the formulation of that document. And that we had these two formative meetings, first over in Dallas and later down in New Orleans. And we went over with a fine-tooth comb all of those statements in that document. And we unanimously and unitedly endorsed it and accepted it and said, yes, this states who we are and what we're about. This sets forth our goals, our mission in life, and why we're dedicating our lives to do it. And it will behoove you, if you have a copy, and if you don't, you can look them up on our website, and we can even send you a copy if you don't have a copy, to read those documents from time to time, as I have begun reading more and more the original documents that actually founded the United States of America. Men of God, as well as men who were not men of God, but men of great vision, and men who accomplished great things, have nearly always been believers in a very great cause that was far bigger and far more important than themselves. Men of avarice, greed, and cunning are never great men. Men who merely look to their own nest, to feather their own nest, to get ahead, to make money, to kind of massage their own ego and to get their way are never great men. But the men that caused this nation to be born, that took it through incredible birth pangs, that almost lost it from time to time, are some of the greatest men. They were not converted men, but they believed in God. They believed in Jesus Christ, every one of them. They wrote about him. Lincoln wrote some tremendous things about belief in God and the nation under God and so on. The Gettysburg Address is an example of it. His proclamation, was not he the one that actually put Thanksgiving in to our national holiday? And isn't there many statements that have been made, not only by all of those early ones, but some that come along as late as Eisenhower, that have talked about this nation under God and have brought God and God's dealing with the United States of America into the picture, and have even proclaimed a full day of fast. So I want now to go to the 11th chapter of the book of Hebrews, because here is a couple of chapters of the Bible that certainly have a great deal to do with what I'm talking about today. It is like a, you might say, the Hall of Fame of God's great people. I'll begin reading in verse 4. By faith Abel offered unto God a more excellent sacrifice than Cain, Hebrews 11:4, by which he obtained witness that he was righteous, God testifying by his gifts, and by it he being dead yet speaks. And we read of his example today. By faith Enoch was translated, that is, he was taken to a different place that he should not see death, and was not found, because people were looking for him, because God had translated him. For before his testimony had this, his translation, he had this testimony that he pleased God. But without faith, as David showed when he faced Goliath, as Abraham showed when he left his family and his country, as Paul showed when he left all of his former constituency, without faith it is impossible to please him. A faithless person, a doubting person, is never pleasing to God. But a person with very powerful faith is very pleasing to God. For he that comes to God must believe that he is. And I have proved that to myself time and time again. You believe that he exists, and that he is a rewarder of them that diligently seek him. And that means in prayer, and sometimes in fasting and prayer, in Bible study, and personal conversations with God. You know, we ought to talk to God even driving along in a vehicle and just say, Father, this or that on a moment. You don't always need to go to a closet and get on your knees. You can actually pray to God going along, and at any point in time when a thought comes into your mind you need to talk about to God, well, just address God, your Father, and talk to him about it. And make yourself realize, don't go trying to talk to an angel, but make yourself realize that God is with you all the time, and that he is available day and night, 24 hours a day. And when you can't sleep at night, get up and start praying. A lot of people fall asleep praying anyway, so that's one method to put people back to sleep sometime. By faith Noah, being warned of God of things not seen as yet, moved with fear, prepared an ark to the saving of his house, by the which he condemned the world, so it did both. It was a witness against the people who were going to drown, and it was the very vehicle of his own salvation, and became heir of the righteousness which is by faith. By faith Abraham, when he was called to go out into a place which he should after receive for an inheritance, obeyed and went out, not knowing whither he went. Neither did Lewis and Clark. Neither did Anson or Frobisher or Ponce de Leon. Neither did Magellan. Neither did Columbus. He thought he'd discovered the East Indies. He'd landed in the West Indies. He didn't know where he was going. He just knew by compass direction he was going in a certain direction. So these men, they weren't all perfect men back then. Even Abraham wasn't a perfect man, but he was righteous before God. Sure, he made the little white lie up, if you can call it a white lie. It was a lie that Sarah was, his sister, but also his wife. And Abimelech had to come to him and say, you could have caused me to commit a great sin. So Abraham used human reasoning on an occasion, but he was a man of God. By faith he sojourned in a land of promise as in a strange country, dwelling in tabernacles with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him in the same promise. Interesting little parallel there, isn't it? They were dwelling in tabernacles looking toward the future of Isaac and Jacob and what they would eventually inherit, just as we at the Feast of Tabernacles also look toward the future of our permanent home. For he looked for a city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. Not Atlantis, but the kingdom of God. Through faith also Sarah herself received strength to conceive seed, and was delivered of a child when she was past age, because she judged him faithful who had promised. Therefore sprang there even of one, and him as good as dead, so many of the stars of the sky in multitude. Now you've got to include in that all the Arab nations and all the so-called Caucasian nations, all of the 13 tribes of Israel, because Ephraim and Manasseh are the two tribes that came from Joseph, and Joseph is one of the 12, but you've also got to include Ishmael of Abraham's seed. So there are literally hundreds of millions of Abraham's kids on the earth today, of Isaac's and Jacob's kids, especially Jacob's kids. But Abraham is their father. You know, Abraham is the father of the Turks and the Iraqis and Saudi Arabians and all those people. He really is, because he was the father of Ishmael. So there sprang one as good as dead, so many as the stars of the sky in multitude, and as the sand which is by the seashore, innumerable. These all died in faith. They didn't die faithless. They didn't have the promise. They didn't see the fruition of the promise. They didn't see exactly what great reward God had promised. They died not having received the promises, but having seen them, because they were men of vision. They saw into the future, having seen them afar off, and were persuaded of them. Their minds were made up. They were convicted, and they embraced them. Just like they loved that promise, it was held close to their bosom, they believed in it, and confessed that they were nothing. They were just strangers and pilgrims on the earth. They were just transitory beings who were here for a little while. Interesting analogy there of where they put their hearts, where they put their minds, what were their plans and their agendas, what do they really look toward? The future. They look toward eternity, they look toward the kingdom of God, they look toward the time when the world is going to be completely back the way it should have been and was before Eve partook of the forbidden fruit. Absolute paradise, beauty beyond our ability to imagine it. For they that say such things declare plainly that they seek a country, and truly if they had been mindful of that country from whence they came out, they might have had opportunity to have returned. But now they desire a better country, that is, an heavenly, wherefore God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared for them a city. Then Abraham's example, when he offered up Isaac, and Isaac's example in verse 20, and Jacob in verse 21, when he was dying, blessed both sons of Joseph. By faith, Joseph, verse 22, when he died, made mention of the departing of the children of Israel and gave commandment concerning his bones. By faith, Moses, we could go back and investigate his life, what kind of a pioneer he was. Age 80, and he is called of God, and he has to go all the way back to a land where he knew there was an arrest warrant out for him, and he could be dragged in and killed because he had slain an Egyptian, and to call these people out, and to be the head of them. Time again, it got him to the place where he just begged God to kill him and just say, I can't handle it anymore. Just wipe me off the face of the earth. How can I put up with these people? And Moses, certainly a great pioneer, wasn't he? By faith, Moses, when he was born, was hid 3 months of his parents because they saw he was a proper child and they were not afraid of the king's commandment. By faith, Moses, when he was come to years, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He had the opportunity. He was a prince of Egypt and could have become a Pharaoh. He chose rather to go back to the Israelites and to become a slave and to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season. What a fabulous decision he made. Talk about sacrifice. He just forsook all of the silks and the wonderful clothing and the, all the licentiousness and the hedonism and everything that was available in that rotten society and said, no, I'm going to go back with my brethren down there in the slave quarters and stomp around in the mud and make bricks. Esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt, for he had respect unto the recompense of the reward of what was lying in the future. What is, people have talked about eternity. And they've said that, if you had a great huge 10-pound steel ball and you had a feather and a feather just touched it every now and then, as long as it took that feather to wear that ball down to nothing, that's the first day in eternity. Anyway, they try to give you an idea of how long eternity is. But when you look and you measure a human lifespan, that by the time you're up my age and the age of some of you here, when you get up toward your 70s and even into your 80s, and you look at what span you've got left and how you're virtually living on borrowed time because your 70 has elapsed, and you say, well, where did it all go? And then you look at eternity and living. How'd you like to live for another 100 years? That'd be great, wouldn't it? It's about 300 years, because by the time it came to the end of 100 years, you'd say, oh, I'd sure like another 100 years. because you're never really ready to go. There's never really a time when you want life, especially when life is good and fulfilling and rewarding and you feel good, when you want life to just quit. And that's the end of it. You want it to go on. So life everlasting is certainly something we all hope and pray for. By faith he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured to seeing him who is invisible. I won't read it all, but let's go to verse 32. What more shall I say? The time would fail me to tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, David, Samuel, and all the prophets who through faith subdued kingdoms. They were men at the center of events, and sometimes it had to do with national governments and with kings that were toppled from their thrones and slain and a new government put in their place. Wrought righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, referral there to Daniel, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, as David did, fleeing from Saul. Out of weakness were made strong, waxed valiant in fight, turned to fight the armies of the aliens. Women received their dead, raised to life again, like the widow when Elijah came. And others were tortured. Not everyone had the same fate. Not accepting deliverance that they might obtain a better resurrection. There's a better resurrection than the second one. And that's the first resurrection. It's the better one. And others had trial of cruel mockings and scourgings. Many of them did, and certainly Christ, worse than any other that suffered martyrdom. Yea, moreover, of bonds and imprisonment. They were stoned. They were sawn asunder. You shudder to think about that. They were tempted. They were slain with the sword. They wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, tormented. These weren't people who dwelt in great mansions and just really enjoyed all the luxuries that the world could provide, even as Moses said, I don't want to be the next Pharaoh. I don't want to be your son here in the palace anymore. I want to be back with my own people. And no doubt his foster mother, who was an Egyptian girl, the daughter of Pharaoh, was heartbroken. Probably did everything, every artifice, cried, sobbed, begged, bawled, did everything she could to get him to change his mind. But his mind was made up, and he was not going to go and sample the Pharaoh's delicacies. He was going to go and join those prisoners. And that's the way he felt about it. Being destitute, afflicted, tormented, of whom the world was not worthy. They wandered in deserts, in mountains, and in dens and caves of the earth, and these all, having obtained a good report through faith, received not the promise, God having provided something better for us, that they without us should not be made perfect. Wherefore, seeing we're also compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, and let me add to that all the ones that I've talked about, from Marco Polo to Magellan to some of the great explorers of the world and the great pioneers of this great land, of this great country, and the sacrifices they made at great cost to themselves. And oftentimes, like Meriwether Lewis, after he came back in 1804 and he came to St. Louis and he was on his way back to Washington to receive all the accolades, and he stopped at an inn along the way, and they went to check on him the next morning, and he was dead by a gunshot wound. And it was never proved to this day whether it was murder or suicide. No one knows. But he never got to return to his wife. No, those men gave up a great deal. Seeing we're encompassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which does so easily beset us. And always people just forget Satan the devil. When it comes to fighting time and arguing time, there is no devil. There is no devil. But that's wrong, isn't it? There is a devil, and they need to clearly identify the enemy and begin saying, look, I know who is about. I know who's doing this. I know who's putting these thoughts in other people's or even my mind. And I better be aware of that and not listen to those whispering enchantments of the devil and instead put my faith and trust in God. The sin which does so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author, that's the beginner, originator, and finisher of our faith. If Christ authors our faith, if Christ gives us our faith, and if he finishes it, then Jesus Christ is the one who imparts to us that quality of character that is called faith. And faith is the evidence of things not seen. It's not merely an emotion, and it's certainly not merely a little hope. It's not just a want to. It is a very almost stolid determination. It's a mind made up. It's like Daniel saying, "We will not worship you, O king, and God will deliver us from that fiery furnace. But if not, O king, let it be known we will not bow down to your idol." Now, God admired that, and God relieved them from that, and God saved them, and they didn't even have their hair singed as a result. But the point was, that was faith coupled with absolute determination. I'm going to do it God's way, no matter what the consequences are. And that's what God wants to see in us. Looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy... This is so contrary to human nature, it just boggles your mind. For the joy that was set before him endured the stake, as that word should read, it is stauros in the Greek, despising the shame. Isn't that an interesting phrase? Because he did not have a little garment draped around him. He was naked on that stake. And it was evident what they had done to him, to lacerate him and mutilate him and beat him. Didn't break a bone, but they did everything short of that. He despised the shame. Some people can't handle any kind of shame. I've known people, I've dealt with people, I've had people who worked for me who couldn't take a single little slight of some kind. A wrong look, a wrong word, an oversight, something that they took great umbrage at that just hurt. Just like when I was a kid, I used to blow up these great big balloons and then hold them and let them go, and they go all around the room. I had a lot of fun with that. They just go everywhere, you know. And especially the great big old long ones that were kind of spiral, because they'd go in a spiral shape, go all over the place, maybe out the door. And that's the way some people are. Their egos are so big, you say one little thing wrong, and kind of like sticking a great big belly, go, the ego just goes all over the place, and they're just absolutely so angry, they just cannot make up their mind, what is the next move? I'm going to get this guy one way or another, because he has pricked my ego. Have you ever dealt with people like that? Some of you work for bosses. All of our employees, now don't say anything, but but anyway, people work for bosses that are like that. And I've known a lot of people like that, who just had ego that they just could not stand. Despising the shame, despise the shame. He didn't have to have great dignity all the time. Jesus was not standing on ceremony all the time. He didn't say, "Young man, do you know who you're talking to?" He didn't put people down like that. He didn't have to have that. He despised the shame and is set down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him that endured such contradiction of sinners against himself, lest you be wearied and faint in your minds. And finally, final scripture, you have not yet resisted unto blood, striving against sin. I haven't. No one has stabbed me. No one has beat me half to death. No one has... cut off a digit. I haven't resisted unto blood. I've resisted unto an awful lot of tears. I've vomited a lot. I've had to fast. I've had to come pretty low oftentimes, striving against sin and Satan the devil. But God always picked me back up and gave me a helping hand and put me on my way again and said, "You keep going down that path." I think these are very important concepts to think about, because sometimes we forget that we are people with a great cause, people of great vision, people of a fabulous future, people of destiny, people who are going somewhere. And we are, believe it or not, one of the many little cadres that exist here and in other nations around the world who are going to become members of Christ's cabinet. We're going to help Jesus Christ form a new government and bring this world peace. And my precious grandchildren, your children and grandchildren, and all those who will come from them, will be able to grow up in a world where there is no such thing as sin and crime and murder and pain and suffering and disease like diabetes that afflicts even little children. Nothing like that will even exist in the world tomorrow, the kingdom of God. And all we can do is pray, "Thy kingdom come."